Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me, as ever, Mike
Cosentino was right over here. Yes, we kind of say my name together now. I kind of like that. That's
I want to make sure you get the pronunciation correct, Mike.
I see.
You know,
I see.
My Italian is superb.
That's true.
Or non-existent, one or the other.
Well, we got a guy with a really simple name this morning. In fact, both his names are less letters than my last name, if we want to get into that.
Stephen Nash. He's not the guy who wrote How to Find a Girlfriend, I don't think. Are you, Stephen?
I am not that guy.
You're not Rich. That Stephen Nash. Stephen Nash is a reporter. He teaches in journalism at the University of Richmond, right, Stephen? And he's won a bunch of awards for his writing. He's written for many of the most famous magazines and newspapers in the country. And he's written a really interesting book about the Grand Canyon, and of course the Grand Canyon is very important to us here in Sedona and the Verde Valley.
Stephen Nash wrote a book called Grand Canyon for Sale. Stephen Nash is that unusual, we're going to talk about him like he's not online here, is that unusual combination of writer and scientist. So he's wrote an interesting book about the science and climate change and the geology and all those wonderful topics in the Grand Canyon. A lot of it is a kind of lore we've been familiar with, at least if those of us that live in Arizona and near the canyon have been familiar with over the years. But he puts it together in a really interesting way and along with lots and lots of other stuff. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
A lot of your reporting is you're actually on the ground, traveling around in the Grand Canyon, and you mix geology and politics and natural science and biology. You've been to the Grand Canyon many times, and there's, about 5.5 million visitors a year to the Grand Canyon, and 99% of them going to the South Rim. Of all the places in the country, I have never seen any place more international than the South Rim of the Grand Canyon in terms of people, except maybe in, some area, tourist area of New York. What's going on with the canyon in the broad thing? How well is it being protected? This is a gem of our national park, and how is it being impacted by commercial interest? I know that I think it was superintendent of the park, tried to ban plastic bottles because they were just piling up everywhere, and he was stopped from doing that.
Yeah, it's a flavorful example on a smaller scale of what's happening to all of our public lands and all of our national park system. This was a superintendent or two ago, but he had seen what happens when plastic bottles begin to spread as almost like a virus in these natural areas. They're very difficult to police, very expensive, whether they're floating down the Colorado or littering a trail. So what he wanted to do was ban plastic bottles, and he wasn't the first to do that. That had already been done in a couple of other parks. But in a really sharply focused example of how private interests are always chewing away at these public resources that belong to all of us. The Coca-Cola bottling company, which makes hundreds of millions of dollars probably selling water in bottles, objected. And they did it through channels in Washington. And so just before that plastic bottle ban went into effect, it was rescinded at the very top of the National Park Service because somebody had interceded. And at first, the Park Service director denied that, but later a journalist got hold of the emails through a Freedom of Information Act request that demonstrated that this had happened. Well, that's not the end of the world. You know, we can live with plastic bottles. The problem is you have to multiply that by thousands of times to see what's really going on at Grand Canyon and throughout the park system and in all our public lands, because private real estate developers and miners and grazers and a whole lot of other people are pulling the same kind of political strings, and they're really degrading these public lands as a result, just when we need to be taking a lot better care of them than we do.
I know one of the problems we have in the wilderness areas around Sedona is overflights of helicopters and small planes and stuff. And that was another issue they were trying to control at the Grand Canyon, that economic interests of John McCain and other senators and congressmen stopped the tighter control over air traffic over the canyon. There's nothing like being in the wilderness and having somebody come flying over you. I talked to the Forest Service, and they said, well, you have to have we don't regulate it. The Federal Aviation Administration does, and they have to be 2,000 feet off the ground, and so you can take a photograph, blah, blah, blah. Impossible to do anything to regulate it, as far as I can see. So what happened at the Grand Canyon?
Well, that experience that you've had and I've had, and that most people who go to Grand Canyon have actually had from time to time, because it's a common one, was what John McCain found when he went to Grand Canyon in 1983 to go on a raft trip. And he was really annoyed is much too mild a word. He was stricken by the idea that this fantastic natural area, this cathedral that is a public resource, was being exploited in this noisy, distracting way by what has turned out to be the largest helicopter fleet on Earth. It's an example of private interests finding a way to make money off the resource. It's the way our system works. It's okay. But there ought to be some places that are sacrosanct. Anyway, I better abbreviate this story. I can't take too much airtime. I'll sound like a cheesy cut-rate Grand Canyon evangelist. But John McCain went into the canyon, maybe with his family, and he came back out and entered the halls of Congress and said, we've got to put a stop to this. It's okay to have some overflights, but we have got to restore natural peace and quiet to the canyon most of the time.
How did that go over?
Well, it didn't go over well with the FAA, a very pro-aircraft crowd. The Park Service was ready to jump in. McCain specified that he wanted it done in 6 months, and the bill was voted into law after a couple of hearings in Congress. 25 years later, it still hadn't happened, largely because of the intransigence of the Federal Aviation Administration. One Park Service official who dealt with them said that they don't care about noise unless it makes your ears bleed. And when it gets to that level, they'll consider it a public concern. But anyway, by then, John McCain was singing a different tune, too. He had raked in hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations from the air tour industry by then. And it's not just a Republican thing, this phenomenon of making use of public resources in this way. Harry Reid, the senator from Nevada, was also instrumental in making sure that the whole process of trying to rein in the terrific noise levels at Grand Canyon was abruptly terminated. Just a few years ago, they scuttled 10 years' worth of science work that the Park Service had done to demonstrate what was going on with noise and how it might be just a little bit pulled back. That was all taken care of with the stroke of a pen in some kind of midnight deal in Congress. And so we've still got the helicopters, a lot of them.
Mike, do you have a question? I want to know what other threats there are to the Grand Canyon. What about you?
Well, we want to do uranium mining. That's certainly in the Arizona news. One of the things I'm looking at also in your book is the quote at the beginning of the chapter about that the national monuments and national parks, including the Grand Canyon, don't necessarily belong to any more to the people that live near it than to, it's a national treasure. And but I do want to talk about where I'd like to go this morning. Stephen Nash, author of Grand Canyon for Sale. I want to talk about uranium mining and its actual impact. One thing I enjoyed in your book was the conversational way you let people know the impact of the uranium mining. And although there's science there, it's also sort of a casual conversation. I want to talk about other public lands. Once again, quoting from Grand Canyon for Sale, 28% of what you call national dirt, I liked, is public lands. And that's a great figure. 20% of our water comes from public parks and public lands. I'm trying to line out maybe a little outline here, but let's jump back to uranium mining. The last chapter, Lost Orphan Mine, you talk about a walk down Hermit's trail.
Rest. Yeah.
Hermit's Rest, thank you. Tell us a little bit about that. What's going on with the uranium stuff?
There's uranium around Grand Canyon, and a lot of people are interested in mining it. There are thousands of claims that have been staked, and what controls it in part is the price of uranium on the world market. When it's looking good, then you get a lot of proposed mining development, a lot of new claims are staked, and it needs to be emphasized, these aren't cases where this is private land. This is all land that belongs to all of us. It's national forest land, or it's BLM, Bureau of Land Management land, or sometimes it's even wilderness areas. So there are these thousands of uranium claims, and during the Obama administration, pretty early on, those public lands were withdrawn from any further mining development. All the mines that had been claimed were grandfathered in, but any new development of uranium mines was withdrawn because of the safety factor. The mining interests say constantly that, well, this is a desert. You know, we don't have to worry about contaminating water with radioactivity. And time and again, they've dug those mines, and the mines begin to fill up with water. The latest example is called the Canyon Mine. I've been there. It's out on national forest land, not far from the border of the national park. And at this point, it's not a national park issue, right? It's not that Grand Canyon alone may be contaminated if the groundwater is contaminated, or the underground aquifers that we sometimes depend on for water are contaminated. There's some worry that the Colorado may be contaminated. It's easy to sound shrill, to sound strident and alarmist about these things, but there are official agencies like the U.S. Geological Survey that have said, look, we don't really know what can happen underground because we haven't mapped these things. It's expensive. The Park Service can't pay for it. The Forest Service can't pay for it. The uranium miners don't want to pay to find out where the aquifers are, where the water flows underground. So nobody can say whether there's a really high danger of radioactive contamination or negligible from these thousands and thousands of mines. What we do know is that order that was given during the Obama administration to withdraw for 20 years until we know more, the federal lands around Grand Canyon from further uranium claims. That's being fought out in court now, and the Trump administration, which is very pro-mining and drilling and grazing and timbering on forest land, they've made noises about making all these public lands much more available for those sorts of uses. So uranium's a big, ugly question mark.
I know that folks look at a map or hear, but, I mean, if you go up to, say, Escalante in the Grand Staircase area, there's There's, I believe there's some oil drilling, even some mining in the northern part of that monument. And there's very intensive cattle grazing. So whole areas of the sort of delicate little rivers that run through it are just chewed up, with cattle, poop and hooves. And I mean, there really are area polluted. The amount of wildlife for hunting or just taking photos of or just looking at is really decreased by all this cattle grazing. I've seen cattle grazing on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. Can you address the issue of grazing? Now, I believe, you know, what was very frustrating for us here in Arizona was that we saw when they seized the refuge up in Oregon, these maps, and they were produced by important eastern newspapers and stuff, showing how much of the land was federal land. But what they neglected was any map that told you of how much of the land, what a percentage of it was used for grazing and mining and sports and everything else. And I believe in your book you say 60% of the federal land is open to grazing.
Yeah, it's partly because of the way we incorporate cowboys in our national mythology. You know, it's politically difficult to do anything about grazing or calling much attention to the damage that that cattle can do in an arid or a semi-arid environment. When I've seen cows out on these desert lands, all my life I've driven by them just like you have on the highways of the Southwest, and I thought, wow, it's pretty cool that somebody can make a living off of putting cows out there, and that the cow can make a living. That's neat. It wasn't particularly offensive, even if it looked a little bizarre. But like you, I saw cattle while I was driving into the north rim of Grand Canyon. Once I almost hit one. They were wandering across the road. I thought, what are they doing here in the national forest? Well, they're doing what all these other private interests do in all these other examples that we've been discussing this morning. But they have some extra political clout because of that beautiful mythology. You know, we wake up in the morning and look in the mirror, and sometimes we see our sort of cowboy forebears. It's part of what we grow up with on TV, and so that's part of it. But it's also true that these people too, just like the helicopter people, have a lot of campaign donations to dispense, not the small ranchers, but the big interests that control public lands. And they don't want the federal government telling anybody, gee, the natural system here is much more important than grazing cows.
It seems like a very uneconomical place to raise cattle. If it wasn't subsidized by these very, very low fees, they couldn't do it. Cattlemen have gotten better.
These are ridiculously cheap. You could feed your goldfish for a month on what it costs to feed a cow for a month on public land. And the problem is they graze things right down to stubble. The land gets badly eroded, the streams are polluted, the wildlife begin to disappear because they can't outcompete the cattle. And again, because it's a place where there's not a lot of rain, the land begins to just degrade more and more, and pretty soon the natural vegetation won't come back at all.
The arroyoing, those deep, if you travel around Sedona, folks, those deep cuts into dirt are arroyoing from overgrazing back 100 years ago, 80 years ago. Cattlemen really have gotten much better about it, I will say that. But it seems like where it makes sense to raise cattle is Indiana, where you have, you know, you grow some stuff and you put the cattle on the lots and they eat actual stuff rather than one head per, you know,
50 acres
square acre miles or whatever it is.
That program by which we allow cattle on public lands costs more to administer In the tens of millions of dollars, it costs more for the American public to allow cows on those lands because somebody has to do the paperwork and, you know, and process all that. More is spent on that than comes in from the leases. That's how cheap it is and how heavily subsidized it is, as you pointed out.
Yeah, the cattlemen's associations went on are very effective here, as elsewhere in the West.
Very powerful.
Keeping
here.
Those rates low.
And I'd like to see those guys run their cattle on a private landowner, which would charge them at least 10 times what they're paid for our public lands to graze on it. And what else, Mike?
Yeah, one of the things I want to mention, Stephen, just even if it's a non sequitur, I want to get this in here that your maps in the book are wonderful, and for those folks that the pictures, all of us actually you could spend hours with the maps and learn so much about what you have to say about Grand Canyon for sale. In your book. Now, you chose that title, Grand Canyon for Sale, because as we're talking this morning, the commercial interests are that which threaten this, going all the way back to John McCain's first visit in the early 80s, to anybody's visit. And I think, as you also mentioned, that many of us have the same experience when we go to the Grand Canyon, especially the first time, but even every time I've been to the canyon, there is this sort of entering the cathedral and noticing always, even if you go to the same places, noticing different marvelous things. It is a special, special place. It's not a deep hole in the ground. Oh, yeah, it is a deep hole in the ground, but it's a lot of other things, too.
It's the lighting, don't you think, Mike, Stephen? It's the lighting is constantly changing.
The poetry of place, the poetry of landscape reaches a high level in the Grand Canyon, so lighting is certainly part of it. But
that's one thing I like about your book, Stephen, is it really evokes the Grand Canyon. We're talking about the political aspects, folks, but Stephen Nash's book really evokes the feeling of the Grand Canyon. And I think that's a great thing. You travel around, you go to some areas that we probably, if we have time, we could mention to folks that haven't probably been to in the Grand Canyon.
I was really fortunate to write a book about such a fantastic place. It was a major motivation for spending a few years pulling the research together. I got to do what you guys get to do much more easily because it's in your backyard. I got to go hiking in the Grand Canyon. It was just wonderful. But listen, I want to pose a question for you since we're dwelling on the poetry of the canyon. What would you think if we just made the canyon a little more convenient and in that tiny little town of 500 souls that you drive through on the way to the South Rim?
Tucson.
What if we put the nation's third largest shopping mall right there?
great idea, Stephen. I love it.
And several thousand condos and, you know, a convention center. What if we could add those amenities? Wouldn't that really make things a lot better? Because that's what's proposed, and it's going to be coming back soon. We have a United States president who's a real estate developer, and although this project was put on ice by the Forest Service when they declined to approve a road that was needed to make it all work, I'm absolutely sure that those conversations are going forward again. In Washington,
I'm sure there are.
And to be built.
It came pretty close the last time. I think you, as you said, it was. You know, at least following it in the print media, it story after story, and up until the relatively, well, you would think, minor decision by the Forest Service, kind of put it all on the back burner again, and everybody breathed a sigh of relief.
There are other projects too, Mike and Stephen, that they're trying to do to commercialize the Grand Canyon. That's probably the worst of them. There really are nice facilities to stay there, folks. There really don't need to be 10,000 more. It's very easy to stay out of the park. It's very easy to get in and out. There's transportation. Part of the year you can drive around, part of the year not. And I'm talking about the South Canyon, where most of the visitors go. It is spectacular. Go ahead, Stephen.
Well, that's just that the bus system is great. I mean, Zion uses it. Lots of the national parks use it. It does make a nice together group of those people on any given moment that are at a place that uses a public transportation rather than private transportation, at least for some of the year.
I think it's too sad. I talked to some of the bus drivers there, and it's a concessionary that controls those the bus drivers, and they're very much underpaid, they told me.
I see.
And they don't have any support. And when they live in the canyons, they bring their trailer to live in the canyon, drive the bus, they have to pay rent. They do a wonderful job, but they're not being treated well, for at least in my conversations with them.
So Stephen Nash, Grand Canyon for Sale, please talk a little bit more about it. I know we're trying not to be shrill here, but please go wherever you want to go with this discussion this morning. We have plenty of time left.
You mentioned the maps.
Yes, please.
I'm glad if you found them engaging. I think a lot of us are like that. We're sort of mapophiles. I can spend a lot of time just staring at a map.
Exactly.
One of those old gas station maps, you know, and just imagine being here or there. And what I'm hoping people imagine as they're paging through this and come across a couple of those maps is what climate change is going to mean for all of these natural areas, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and Yellowstone and Yosemite and a wonderful Glacier National Park, the whole system of parks and forests and public lands and wilderness areas and wildlife refuges is already under a quite high degree of stress. But with climate change, the stress levels are going to ratchet up very high. If it's hard to get agitated about what's happening to public lands that we don't even see very often, keep in mind that what these maps show is that climate change is going to shove Grand Canyon, in terms of its climate, down to the Mexican border here in just a few decades. It's going to take Yellowstone National Park and move it 300 or 400 miles south just in the next few decades in terms of its climate. That means that all of the plant life and all of the animal life is going to have to adapt by being able to migrate either north most of the time into a cooler kind of latitude or to higher elevations. Well, the more we can glue these public lands together, all of them, and consider all of them a kind of a national preserve, the easier time those plants and animals are going to have as they're sort of coping with climate change, and it's coming on very rapidly. The more we chop them up and sell them off for gas and oil development, real estate development, the more we graze them and mine them, the more we destroy the chances, the survival chances for all of these wonderful species that the national parks were created in part to protect. And the maps show that, I hope, as vividly as I wanted them to. Did you get that out of those pictures?
I really did. That was very good. When I brought it up, that was the map I was thinking of. And I want to just say that visually, that you know, they have the existing park, let's say Grand Canyon, and then you have arrows and charts and things. And boom, this is where it's going to be mid-century, and this is where the climate and flora and fauna are projected to be, or at least the conditions will be the same at the end of the century. So, and the southern migration of that is huge. But all of the maps, like I said, we're talking about the west, but we aren't also talking about the east. We're talking about public lands. in general, and Grand Canyon specifically this morning.
So we have to get prepared for more than just the commercial impacts on our national parks and monuments. We have to be prepared for the impact of global warming and the change of climate. And I think we can feel it here, especially in a year like this. I was talking to a professional photographer. I said, there's so many pictures of the vistas of Sedona, but we really need to catalog and get out and show the wonderful plants we have here, because people tend to ignore our plant life. I know the animals are hard to get pictures of. I took a course at the Museum of Natural History, and somebody who was a lot brighter than I did asked the teacher, he said, what's the hardest part of wildlife photography? And he said, getting pictures of the front end of the animal. Stephen's Nash's book is humorous. It's a fun read, as well as filled with a lot of technical and scientific information on the geology of the canyon, and a lot of a broad discussion of political issues. We have people who are opposed to public lands here, Stephen. What do you think?
Yeah, more of them all the time, and some of them are on the violent end of things. You mentioned the takeover of the wildlife refuge in Oregon, and of course the whole Clive and Bundy episode is very close to home for Arizonans. But a much more sophisticated and extremely well-financed movement is underway to bust up all public lands and sell them off to private interests directly, or give them to the states to dispose of as they wish. Even the Arizona legislature considered, with some enthusiasm before a Republican governor vetoed it, considered the idea that all public lands in Arizona should be taken over by the state. And from there, who knows what could happen.
One of our representatives, Sylvia Allen, was behind that.
And Bob Thorpe. Yeah.
And Bob Thorpe. Our representatives do not believe in public lands. They want to use, they call it higher use. And that is, they want to look at public lands, they want to privatize them, and they want to sell them off to whoever can make the most money from them. I think it's an absolutely terrible idea, but it is the idea that our representatives do represent. If you don't like that kind of attitude, folks, be sure to vote this next election. That is really absolutely. American political power comes directly from getting out and voting. And I think the slogan that not registering and not voting is a surrender. It's not a protest. So we have a serious issue, Stephen. Talk about a little bit nationally. You're getting started on that. It certainly impacts us here.
Well, people who can do well, and some of them certainly do very well, and I don't begrudge them that as long as they leave our public lands alone. But people who can get something out of public lands are people who know often how to pull strings and how to spend money in Washington and in state legislatures to begin to relax what few regulatory controls we have over those public lands. And, you know, I use the Grand Canyon as sort of my foreground example for the whole of public lands and what's befalling them. But my foreground example for these political interests that are so successful are a team that you may have heard of in the past, the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H. The two Koch brothers are among the 10 wealthiest people on the planet. They're tied, I think, for ninth place in the Fortune magazine tally of that.
Didn't they get a huge tax break recently, Stephen?
I'm sure they get huge tax breaks every minute of every hour. But
we're going with Koch brothers, by the way.
They are ranchers on public lands. They own some big ranches, but really, their major interest and major source of incomes is from oil and gas drilling, and a lot of that is done by the Koch brothers on public land. So you can imagine, because of that and because of their political ideology, which is ferociously anti-government, it demonizes government, you can imagine that the very idea that the public, all of us, should own public lands is not at all agreeable. It's an obstacle to be overcome. The Koch brothers, by the way, don't think of climate change as a threat, and they found a way to spend tens of millions of their money trying to slow down our ability to do anything about that, too.
Yes,
they're an example, again, of the forces that are trying to break up public lands just when we need to be consolidating them.
I used to tell the guys I work with, if you break up public land, you guys, and we're a bunch of tour guides, you guys are not going to end up with big chunks of public land. The Koch brothers are going to end up with it. The big money is going to buy it all, and you're going to end up with no place to go hunting and fishing and so forth and so on. But the ideology is very strong, and Stephen Nash is really a part of our Arizona politics, of our representatives. And our governor, and the amount of secret money coming in here, amount of hidden money, we call it dirty money now, coming into Arizona from the Koch brothers and their ilk, the whole crew of extremists, is amazing. And it affects elections. Their hatred of, I don't know. Somehow this has to be worked through. This intense hatred of public government, these attacks on people in the Foreign Service, it's got to play out somehow, and people realize how foolish it is. But anyway, I won't go on. Stephen, tell us a little bit more about what do you think is important takeaway from your book, for example, or.
Well, I think you rang the right bell when you talked about how people need to engage on this problem and so many others that need attention, where the majority of people in Arizona are already well wised up to these threats, and the majority of people out here in Virginia where I live, because of gerrymandering, it's more difficult to make that political will count at the ballot box, but it still does count. And these are problems. These are problems that the nation faced when the national parks were created. Teddy Roosevelt had to look into the barrel of the same gun when the Grand Canyon was created as a national monument back more than 100 years ago. He had to overcome the same grasping local political forces. He had to work with Congress until that protection was granted, and later it became a national park. He could do that because he had public support. He couldn't do it as a petty tyrant or as some kind of crazy man with his own agenda in the White House. He did it because Congress knew and local officials came to know the wisdom of creating national parks and of protecting public lands. He did it out of personal courage, but he did it because all of us, if we were around back then, were supporting him. And that's what's needed now. It's not as if this is a hopeless problem. That's my takeaway.
That's an excellent, and that's correct. All of those users of Zion and Bryce, every park in southern Utah, every park in northern Arizona, and you mentioned so many of them, they had a free day April 21st, and there was millions and millions of people in the national parks. I don't know what those people that are representing us are looking at. They're certainly looking at a few friends.
They're looking at a paycheck.
They're looking at a few friends, not at the masses of people that they're supposed to be representing. And that's, as you said, the long time problem from Roosevelt's day before and after. It's still the same. Dollars and threats that and I even though I did, what we didn't get to this morning, we did we mentioned it a little bit, but certainly in the time left, or at least I want to jump back for a second, although this is certainly not good outlining here. Water, we talked about water, and we talked about so much of our water, especially in Arizona, it comes from aquifers, folks. The well on my property, if I didn't have a well, I would be drinking water from probably the same aquifer from the city's well. And so this fragile thing and this unknown thing, as you pointed out, now USGS has, the United States Geological Survey has done some mapping in northern Arizona. They could do the same mapping in the Grand Canyon if they were allowed. Yes, is that true, Stephen?
Not just allowed. It's really, really expensive. So the idea is often suggested, if you're a private property developer and you want to stick your soda straw into an aquifer that we all have to subsist on, then let's get you to pay in advance to see where the water is and how much of it there is. But the USGS can't afford that. Their political enemies would like to reduce their budget to nothing. And even when they were feeling well-heeled, they couldn't afford those monitoring wells, as they're called. But private interests can afford them as part of development cost. And if we want to know where the water is and what development is reasonable, that's how to find it out.
Yeah, there's almost no regulation in northern Arizona, and there are vast development interests who are wanting to put in huge developments like the one up in Tucson, and they don't even know how much water they're going to be taking. They don't know the effect on the aquifer. And one of Mike's big issues is the Verde River that runs through our valley. If these giant wells are and huge, basically cities without a core are built out on the aquifer, whether our river will continue to run. It's the last free running river in Arizona.
Is that right? Yeah, I've ridden that wonderful Verde Valley Railroad. Is it still there?
Yeah, it's still there. It's still cooking.
And seen that river. It's a fragile thing.
We've got bald eagles nesting along it.
Somebody is trying to protect it.
Yes. Well, you know, hopefully we'll have somebody on from Friends of the Verde River soon. We've gone through and this is a little off topic, but we've gone through a consolidation of our river groups to the betterment of them all. In other words, four groups have formed into one, which gives them much more clout and a bigger budget, as you can imagine. And
that's great.
Besides the headwaters that are facing massive development, and quite frankly, I think we're going to lose that as a source for the Verde River. And when Stephen says it's the last running river, it's the last river with its origin in Arizona, you know, Colorado, other obviously rivers run through Arizona from other sources. But we're going to find out when we have the guests, but I'm going to say 40 or 50% of the flow of the Verde River does come from springs and seeps and sorts of things that aren't yet affected by the massive development in Prescott Valley and sticking all those soda straws, as you said, into the aquifer.
We have an announcement.
Yes, we want to take a minute here to talk about a wonderful movie, Backpack Full of Cash, down at Mary Fisher Theater. This is being presented
on Tuesday, May 1st.
May 1st. That's tomorrow. That is tomorrow at 4 p.m. and at 7 p.m. If you're wondering where all the money goes, and this was a big topic on Facebook, where's all the money for education going? What are those lousy teachers doing with it? Obviously, they're not paying themselves. They're striking and they're marching in the streets in Arizona and maybe a couple of other states in the next few days, Colorado, Oklahoma. So what are they doing with all the money? Well, Matt Damon is one of the producers of this movie, Backpack Full of Cash, and it's going to be here two times tomorrow. Please go see it. The movie will at least attempt to describe where the money is going. It is certainly not going to teachers, and it's certainly not going to textbooks.
So we need to thank Stephen Nash for his fine book, for coming on the show today, Grand Canyon for Sale. Excellent book. It's a great fun read, Mike.
Yep.
And I hope people will pick it up.
Yeah, and it's available. And it's a Kindle edition, hardcover. Last comment, Stephen, before we go into other announcements.
Thank you both very much. It's been great talking with you.
Well, thank you. I hope I hope your message gets out. It's the Grand Canyon and public lands. Certainly here at Democratic Perspective is sort of a constant theme. Hopefully you won't get tired of it. Don't forget, this and all our shows are on podcast at vvid.org. Catch this show and all our shows at vvid.org. Thanks, folks.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.